All right, so you've spent your time in school really refining your technical skills and knowledge, but you understand that clinical practice is messy. You realize that strong interpersonal connections, communication skills, and the ability to think critically are crucial for success in clinical practice.
If only there was a clinical mentorship process aimed exactly at that.
Oh, wait, there is. Enter the Level Up Initiative, your solution for quality mentorship for students and new grads targeted at helping to cultivate top-notch critical skills and communication skills. Oh, and did we mention it's free?
Yep, you heard that right. If you want to develop these critical skills and connect with a badass network of forward-thinking providers, then the Level Up Initiative is for you.
Their next enrollment process opens June 15th for an August 1st start date.
Head on over to www.thelevelupinitiative.com and learn more about what they do and see why over 1,000 students and new grads have trusted Level Up Initiative in helping them grow. Feel free to reach out to us directly with any questions.
See you in June. What's up, listeners? This is Jared and Tyler here. Here's a quick intro. We have Chris Johnson, Dr. Chris Johnson, on this episode today. This episode was recorded like a year ago, so this is definitely a pre-COVID conversation, and excited to have you join in as he drops a bunch of knowledge bombs on us. Music.
We like this cow. It's kind of one of those things, it's like the duck. You know, you see a duck in the water, right? The duck looks like it's cool, but the duck's freaking working hard under the water. Wow, working hard. That's how our place is. We look cool, but we're working hard.
We are based out of Austin, Texas right now.
So Tyler and Jared, and then Trace is good. You live with names first.
Yeah.
Tyler and Jared, we're all three of us are in Austin. Trace is just about... If there's no traffic, he's 20 minutes north of Austin. If there is traffic, he's an hour north of Austin.
I actually did one of my internships or affiliations at Brackenridge Hospital.
There you go.
Yeah. So I stayed at a guy's place, Doug Brown, who is just one of the coolest people in the world. He's a pediatric therapist, but he's over in, Africa most of the year. He still does, I think, contract work in the school system, but he has a foundation called It Starts With Soccer. But anyways, sync up with this guy. He's a pretty low-key dude. You know, he flies under the radar, but he's poster child for the physical therapy profession.
It Starts With Soccer? Do you know what's that about?
He was basically, I mean... I think, you know, had he been groomed a little bit, he would have been playing professional soccer. I think he played MLS, but it was during its infancy. So, he probably didn't get a lot of notoriety, but just such a great guy, you know, freak athlete. But talk about someone who has their priorities and their morals straight. It's Doug Brown, but no one would know him because he has his morals straight.
Heck yeah. When were you down here?
I was down there probably 2001 or two, and I literally went down there to ride my bike, and I had a great affiliation. I had some incredible CIs, and I was doing acute level neuro in wound care, and it was such an eye-opening experience. I mean, have you guys ever rotated through a wound care facility?
Ooh, nope. Not a whole facility. No.
Yeah, not a, I've done a little bit, but not a whole facility of it.
Talk about eye-opening. You know, when I see an incision from like an orthopedic surgeon, I'm like, we're good. Yeah, there is a woman I remember when I was there. I could sit here and tell you stories for an hour. But this woman literally had like a cage in the region of her stomach. And she was joking with me. She's like, I can put donuts there. I can put like cans of Coca-Cola. One of my first evals was a guy who I walked in and he was picking his beard and eating it. I'm like, what the hell is going on? And he was apparently hit by a train and it was brain matter that he was eating.
Whoa.
Yeah.
What?
So,
whoa. Yeah.
God. That's scratching the tip of the surface.
So, oh, God.
Yeah. So for anyone who hasn't rotated, and it was a big diabetic population. You would see people come in with like literally what looked like a pinprick in the region of their fifth toe. And you would see him walk out a couple weeks later with a transtibial amputation.
Jesus.
Yeah, so eye-opening.
Thought we were going to talk about running, Chris. What is this? What is this stuff making me
running,
feel?
I bring this up because running's so easy.
Yeah.
You know, in the sense that you have people who are highly motivated, that generally have, you know, the necessary resources to push the needle, and you have very predictable performance demands, and they're all atraumatic injuries. Like, we're good to boogie, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I always rotated through everything but sports medicine on my fills because I basically spent 3 to 4 years with a orthopedic surgeon who taught me the ropes as far as like evals and, you know, priorities and triage and stuff like that. He didn't know anything about running, you know, nor did I at that point. You know, I was just like a hippie tennis player. So, but yeah, here we are. So I appreciate you guys having me on.
Of course.
Man. Yeah. Appreciate you coming on.
Was that your toughest eval? The brain matter beard?
I had this CI who is just so rock solid. All of them were tough in different ways. You know, sometimes you'd be working with someone who, you know, was a drug addict who had some, you know, apparently trivial wound that they didn't take care of that went south. I saw it all. So that was one of those affills that I hope other people have an experience like that, because it just opens your eyes and also realize it makes you fully appreciate how well all the different settings that a physical therapist can end up in.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the beauties of our profession, is that we cover such a landscape. And I hope people take care, they take advantage of these affiliations that they may not otherwise get, because once you get into like outpatient ortho, it's a different sector. And you're not exposed to a lot of these things that really make you hone your skills. So when you see something in outpatient ortho that, you know, seems like things are going awry, you're in a better position to handle it while keeping calm.
Hmm.
But yeah, I had some tough CIs, man. You know, but it was, and they were all women. They were great. And, but they were tough as nails, and they were just incredible clinicians. And I realized that I knew nothing. So,
yeah, man. So you mentioned earlier, backing up, that you said you were a tennis player mm-hmm. at that time, and you grew up playing tennis and soccer, and now you're this, you know, Ironman triathlon guru. When did you start, how did that whole come about? When did you start cycling or become a cyclist or swimming?
Well, I was dabbling in, you know, I grew up riding BMX, you know, like when I was 3 years old, you know, my parents would be getting calls from the neighbor. They're like, hey, your son's like a couple miles away. He's in our neighborhood on a bike. I was on a Schwinn Pixie. And the thing was like a death trap. I mean, it was like the aluminum was sort of peeling off, and I'd just storm around. Half the time I'd like ride over hills and go over into pricker bushes or like ride into walls. Like, but you know, that's how you learn, right? So I ditched the training wheels pretty quick. Kids don't have training wheels these days. They're on push bikes. I wish I had a push bike. It would have saved me a lot of time and energy. But so I was always dabbling in all these different sports. And I was swimming loosely through the age of probably 12, and then got away from it a little bit, got back into it in college. So I've just always been a multi-sport athlete. And I think that, you know, there are so many things that you learn from taking part in sports that, you know, you think have nothing to do with the end game. Like at this point, it's swim, bike, run. But, you know, I was talking about this on the Runner Zone today, which is that online platform I have, and I'm not sitting here to like plug that, but, you know, I was listening to this fellow who's a friend of Nick Kyrgios, who's an Australian tennis player, who's super talented, who's a total head case. And once he gets his head right, and stops being such an egomaniac, he's going to go on to be a world champion. But they were interviewing this friend of his who I think plays for the Celtics. I'm drawing a blank on his name, but he said, you know, I played all these sports growing up, and there are so many things I learned that I didn't fully appreciate that would help me in basketball. He plays for the Celtics right now. And And I had a, you know, firsthand experience of that today. I was out riding my bike. I was going like 35 miles per hour. I had a tailwind and I was on a 2-lane highway, a major highway. And all of a sudden there was this monster pothole and I had to bunny hop the thing. And had I not had that background in BMX and mountain biking,
wow,
I would be in an ambulance right now, if not dead. So, you know, I think it's so critical, as much as someone wants to focus on a particular sport, that you dabble in all these sports, and it just fosters athleticism through the roof. But it's so tough to really, I think, accept that as a reality when you're younger and you're trying to basically maybe have scouts or college recruiters, you know, put you on their radar. So,
yeah.
You have cookie, I see you have Cookie Monster in the background.
Hey. Yes. In the clinic right now.
Yeah.
That shows I have a poor diet. My patients like they like to bring me cookies.
You get like a monthly membership to Tiff Street.
They're like, oh, you like cookies? I'm like, yeah. And then they just send
it. Cookies and coffee all day.
Yeah, cookies and coffee. Bring me that. Speaking of that, your the place up in Seattle that you – oh my goodness, I'm gonna mess up that M word that you train at.
I'm out of there, Metier. Yeah.
Oh, you're out of there?
I run everything out of my residence. We have a daylight basement and I have a performance space there. And so basically treadmill, smart trainer for the bike, squat rack, basically everything that you need to push the needle, which is great, you know, because I mainly do consultations these days. And I also don't think that we need to be doing a lot more than that for the most part. I think a couple follow-ups here and there, especially if you have someone with a complex presentation with a bone stress injury or a tendon-related disorder. But yeah, we're in an interesting time in the physical therapy world.
So this is the one big question that I have a bunch of questions, if you can't
but
tell.
But the big one.
The big one. No. I'll let you do the big one. The New York one.
Oh, that one. Okay.
Well, yeah. I'll let you take that one.
I'll write a book about New York someday. Yeah.
So something, I don't know, when I think of you and your history of running or history of sports and all these crazy injuries and things like that, near-death experiences, what is one of the tougher – I've had some injuries, but what is one of the tougher injuries that you had to come over or to overcome that you were like, man – rotator cuff repair is tough. Like what is one of the ones that you seem to looking back on?
This is going to sound, this may catch you off guard a little bit, but a rectus strain playing soccer. And I've been through a number of orthopedic surgeries. I would say that I had an osacromiale, which, ended up being fused. I don't know. I mean, obviously, my outcome is a testament to the fact that it was the right decision. But I was getting some painful arc. You know, I was playing tennis at the time, and I was losing some velocity and having pain when I was in a high five position. Obviously, that's going to negatively impact the serve. But I think the rectus strain was such a debilitating injury. And that was from kicking a wet soccer ball on goal from about 30 yards out as hard as I could. And it was a classic case of mismanagement early on where you think, oh, dial it back, rest, wait for the pain to subside, and then plug back in. And when I went to plug back in maybe 3 to 4 weeks later, you know, I was good for like, you know, basically one touch, you know, games or drills. But when I went to actually kick the ball, I restrained it. And I have a hole, Barry, of looking at my upper thigh. But there's a palpable defect in that rectus muscle. And it wasn't until, and I think this is the first time that I developed an appreciation for the role of a physical therapist, because I connected with this guy, Steve Hoffman, who really was known as an overhead athlete rehab specialist. He was working with the Pirates at the time. He was in one of the original, the athlete shoulder with Kevin Wilk and Jim Andrews. But he rehabbed me through that injury, and he was exposing me to a lot of gnarly eccentrics and high loads once the time called for it. And that's what got me back. And I haven't had a single issue since then. And I think that muscle strains are just so mismanaged by practitioners or clinicians. So
how long did that actually like knock you down for?
I was out for probably a total of, I want to say roughly 8 to 10 weeks before I could finally get back into a game situation. And I used to play left midfield, so I was running a lot, and I was known to basically serve up crosses from the left side, you know. And obviously when you're hitting a cross, you're not like hitting a chip shot, you know, you're trying to basically crank the ball halfway across the field. So yeah, that was my second exposure to physical therapy. And that was with the lower extremity injury. I always played baseball and overhead sports. So, but yeah, such a debilitating thing. And like I said, I think these still are mismanaged by a lot of clinicians.
What's the biggest error that we face when treating a strain?
I don't think exposing people to the loads and the rate of force development that you really need to be exposed to. So I think you always have to look at the performance demands of a sport. You know, with a lot of two joint muscles, they're prone to strains, and it's at that musculotendinous junction. And I think that clinicians do a great job of calming things down and doing some low level exercises. But from there, I don't think that they fully expose the athlete to, you know, the forces that are at play, you know, especially if you're playing on a competitive level. So
have you ever had any like major triathlon related injuries, or has that been fairly safe for you since you know more what you're doing now and how to rehab it and prehab stuff?
I've dealt with one running related injury, and I don't know. I still look back on the situation. I was running in a pair of Hokas, and you know, I developed an Achilles tendon issue. It was just a reactive Achilles tendinopathy. And, you know, as a clinician, I knew what I was doing at that point. I said, this thing's reacting, it's sensitized, and I just dialed things back. And 3 to 4 weeks later, I was back doing intervals full gas. I think a lot of times people are in denial when they're dealing with a tendon-related disorder, and especially if it's first time, just remove the offending force. So in that case, no energy storage and release. But I think that's a tough pill for a lot of people to swallow, because when you're dealing with a running-related injury, and that's a big part of your life, you know, it can negatively impact you on several levels. I guess I'll say I'm wise at this point, and I just respected it for what it was. But I remember walking. I was out on, like, I was going to go for a 30-minute walk with my wife, and I'm like, I have to go home. You know, 10 to 15 minutes. I'm like, I can't even walk normal. And I think a lot of people don't respect what's going on when they first hit, and they keep sensitizing it. And look, we're all clinicians here, so it's a huge advantage, you know, to have some appreciation for the moving parts. But back to answer your question, I've slammed to the ground. Like we could sit here and talk about my shoulders. I'll spare you the images, but I've gotten in a couple really dicey situations in terms of my clavicles. So obviously, with triathlon related injuries, it's when trauma does hit, it's on the bike. And it is just, have you guys ever sustained a clavicle fracture?
No.
Yeah, I did back when I was playing Little League Baseball. I slid back into like one of the third baseman's shin and just hit my collarbone right on his shin and fractured it.
Yeah, in conservative management, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yep. When you can get back to doing a push-up hold and then a full range push-up, you're probably good.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, I mean, the first one I managed conservatively in New York, and I was under the care of Dr. Nicholas, junior, not senior, and all of his partners were like, Chris, I get that operated on. He's like, look, man, he's like, all you do is ride your bike and train. Like, if anyone's going to rebound this, rebound from this, it's you. And there's a saying, when two ends of a clavicle are put in the same room, they tend to find each other. And the concern is obviously a malunion or a non-union. So it ended up healing. Now, I will say this. When you have clavicle fracture, my clavicle was shortened and my shoulder just protracts on my right side. And it used to be rock solid. So what you appreciate after going through a clavicle fracture, and this is just a classic mid-shaft clavicular fracture, that clavicle pins that shoulder girdle back. So as tough as this is to deal with, you learn so much going through injuries. Now, knowing that, I had this one fixed, and I was in Hawaii, and I had a doc who, look, this is a pretty routine procedure. He was a head of the orthopedic department in Kauai, which is one of relatively more off the beaten path islands. And when he put the plate and screws in, the end of the plate was hanging into my AC joint. So I didn't do any swimming for 9 months. And I would go to do a push-up, and I'm like, geez, this thing feels nuts. So I ended up having it removed. And things are good. But I'll tell you what, I've dealt with some gnarly sensations here, because I think that they cut through my platysma. Like, if I compare this left to right, you would see that they're like, they obviously, you know, probably cut part of it. And I've been dealing with all these weird sensations through here. But I'm glad that I had the hardware out, because, you know, I would do a push-up with the hardware in and I'm like, this feels like hell. And since I have it removed, I'm back to everything. And, you know, I've raced 2 half Ironmans, a full Ironman, and I'm racing Kona. So.
Yeah, you've been to Kona twice. What's that experience like?
Yeah, this will be the third time.
You're going again?
Yeah, so in about 6 weeks, 5.5 weeks.
Oh,
yeah.
My goodness.
Yeah. It's crazy. I mean, there's a saying that qualifying for Kona is more fun than racing Kona. But, you know, I'll try and get after it. It's such a logistical issue, guys. I mean, with kids these days,
yeah.
You know, my wife puts me in a position to do this. My family puts me in a position to do it. But it's such a juggling act, especially as an entrepreneur. But it's also a big part of my business, where it gives you street cred. So. Yeah. You know, when you qualify, you definitely want to take your spot.
When do you train?
The question is, when do I sleep and work?
Yeah.
So today I got out on a 60-mile hilly ride in Pittsburgh. I train every day. I try to train twice a day, and I don't know. It's such a convoluted situation. I try to work this in. So I've taken a lot of my training indoors, just because it's a lot more time efficient and there's no off. Like if you go outside and you're going down a hill, you may coast a little bit, but when you're on one of these smart trainers, I'm in my basement with mirrors in front of me, and I just plug in different workouts from an online training platform, and and I have a treadmill there, so yeah, I do so much of my training indoors. And look, this is a pretty boring, monotonous sport. People are like, oh, you know, I don't know how you do it. I'm like, well, you just have to know what you're signing up for. I love the monotony of it. And it's just refining. When people say, what are you up to? I'm like, I'm still learning to try to ride a bike. So.
There's no potholes in your basement, dude, so that's nice.
Seriously. If you ever have a clavicle fracture and you ride a bike, I literally used to know where every single pothole was on my rides around New York. And I'm not joking about that. I hit a pothole one night, and it was sort of around dusk. And I'm like, oh, gee, I definitely refractured. And thankfully, nothing happened. But nothing is more jarring, especially when the bone's in the process of healing.
Are you listening to music while you're training?
Hell yeah. Well, but I do most of my training solo. And, everyone's like, oh, that's dangerous. I'm like, it's not dangerous. when you're riding a bike, you have to be very predictable. You have to go out at times of the day where the traffic is a little bit lighter. Look, I just assume everyone in Seattle is high, drunk, and texting. I am very mindful of the routes that I take. But that's another reason why I do so much of my training indoors. And most of the pros do a lot of their training indoors for the same reasons. Because we live in a distracted world, and I'm not going to sit here and act like an angel where, you know, I'm not occasionally texting on my phone or getting directions or doing something like that. But yeah, I try to be calculated in terms of when I go out and who I ride with. There's one or two people that I'll ride with, and outside of that, I don't go out on group rides. That's a rarity. Just because I don't know the level of the rider. I don't know how comfortable they are. They start half wheeling you, meaning like they're actually like coming up and they're almost side by side with you. That's dangerous. So, and I also do most of my training on a road bike, even though I'm a triathlete. It's just much safer. You can recover faster. It's more forgiving on your low back. But that's sort of getting into programming.
Oh, yeah. Oh, speaking of training and whatnot, how's the app come? What was it like creating an app? What, you know, that's always like, you're always sitting around with your friends like, we should make an app for that. And you did make an app for that.
Those smart people. Those with their apps.
Well, it was a learning experience. And it's something that the app world is always changing, and pricing it and marketing and, you know, teaming up with the right group of programmers. Yeah, there's a lot of moving parts, and you know, I've joked before in saying that, you know, a lot of people talk about rolling out an app over dinner, and maybe they can. I know Scott Morrison has put together a pretty simple app in terms of looking at torque measurements, and I think that's great, and he probably did that in a practical, cost-effective manner. It's dealing with a lot of the emails on the back end. Like, you know, I was in conversation with a guy from Malaysia today who's like, hey, I have this iPhone 10 and your app's not working. And I'm like, well, hey, can you send me screenshots? Here's what I would suggest doing. And he's like, it doesn't work. I'm like, okay, can you send me screenshots? Can you, you know, you're trying to troubleshoot. And I think people get pretty impatient because they just expect this stuff to, they pull it up and it's firing on all cylinders. And sometimes people don't realize it, you know, with the phone that you have to hold it in your hand or have an elbow strap because it's based off of the accelerometer. So it's basically plus minus. But yeah, it's definitely an uphill climb. But I think that you have to sign up for things. Like, you can't be afraid of failure. And that app is such an incredible resource for clinicians in particular. And, you know, I do a lot of training to beats. Like, you see my videos, it's very rhythmic and beyond running. So this is an app that obviously it has salience to runners, but has so many uses beyond that. You know, it's like if you're doing rotator cuff work, you could do it at 60 beats per minute. You could do it at 90. You could do it at 120. You could do it at 180. And I think clinicians, and I'm guilty of this too, I think that it's very easy to fall into habit and routine. So I am just constantly tinkering with things. That's why I'll go back to get a PhD after my kids get out of the nest, maybe even a little bit before, because I'm just still so fascinated about what I'm up to in the clinic. And it's interesting because a lot of the research that comes out validates a lot of the things that I've found over time. But don't get me wrong, I've been wrong on countless times, but a lot of the different exercises and loading progressions, and when you see the EMG data on certain exercises, I'm like, that makes perfect sense, because I've tinkered with this stuff like every which way. So, and that's all those videos are online. It's me playing with movement. I'm thinking of like Todd Hargrove's book. That's all it is.
And thanks so much for those videos and for that app. Whenever I have a running patient, a runner come in, I immediately channel you. What would Chris Johnson do? And I've I've made people download their Run Cadence app countless times here. Like, listen, got to download this app. It's going to be all about your cadence. Like, I'm not a runner, but this is what we're doing. This is how we're going to get you back to doing your activities.
Greg Lehman, he always will joke and say, you know, when in doubt, turn your feet over faster. And, you know, he just has a way of dancing with the literature, but that's essentially what it supports. And it's the closest thing to a home run in the literature. You know, there is maybe one study that questions the role of cadence manipulation. But I also think it's something that's very misunderstood by a lot of clinicians. So hopefully the app helps people apply some of the science to it. And it's been a fun endeavor. We would love to get it on Android, but you know, these apps are not cheap.
And Android users don't deserve that luxury. It's not. another big influence that you have on me is the use of metronome work and making sure people focus more on that tempo. I think you talked about clinicians not understanding how to treat strains. I think another one is not utilizing tempo work enough.
Agreed.
Rehab setting.
And, you know, it's nice to see Ebony Rio's work come out, though I think that some of her work, obviously it's not just her and her colleagues out of Joe Cook's lab. I think that they started to highlight the role of cadence, especially in dealing with patellar tendinopathy. And a lot of their work was based off of Leung's study from 2015, where, you know, she always talks about basically like the learner-driver scenario, where it's like, you know, you have your foot on the gas and brake at the same time, and the metronome gets you out of your head. And it forces you to focus on an external cue, and that's the beauty of it. And it's awesome. Like, we have two little kids. When you put on music, they'll just sync up to the beat. But adults do that too. So, you know, the metronome's good. Music's good.
Nice.
What are you guys drinking? I see you sipping on some coffee.
This is just a little sparkling water.
Yeah, Mountain View.
You know, us Austinites, we got a Topo Chico or whatever.
They're a sponsor of the show. I'm sipping on Clean. Shout out to Clean for sponsoring this episode. Clean, yum.
A Bud Pounder or something.
Delicious. Delicious sparkling. Sparkling water is all the rage right now.
You have sponsors for your podcast? You guys are doing it right.
No,
we just call out the now. Thanks to Yeti for sponsoring this podcast.
Yeah, man. Shout out to Yeti. Great microphones there, but computer audio is just as good.
We're just hoping they just pick up one day.
That's,
we'll just keep pitching.
Yeah. That's really how we go about everything. Hey, Apple, do you want to sponsor our podcast?
Stay after it. You know, there's a well, I'll tell you a story after we get off this, but stay persistent. Mm-hmm. You know, it's so funny. When you look at certain folks in the online community, consistency gets rewarded. You know, and I think I'm not sitting here giving you you guys aren't asking for advice, but one thing that I've learned is like, you stay consistent, and 10 years later is like, it starts to pay off. But it's a hustle. You know, this stuff requires, I mean, you guys getting on this call, having to edit it, send me the email, dealing with me running late because of family situations. You just have to be super patient and persistent as hell. So
it's that grit.
Yeah. That's all triathlon is. You know, it's like day in and day out, you have to just keep training. You're having a bad day. You know what? Grow up, toughen up. And you have to get it done. Maybe you need to adjust, but at the same time, you need to get it done.
Are you going to push your, you have children, right?
Two. I have a little boy, Kai, who's sleeping right now. You may have heard him screaming. But yeah, so we have, he's 1 year and a few months, and then we have a amazing 3-year-old daughter who, she'll go on to do amazing things in the world.
Awesome. Are you going to push them towards athletics?
No? I'll just expose them to everything under the sun. You know, gymnastics, ballet, soccer, skateboarding. They're already on bikes. I'm going to give them such a movement smorgasbord.
Yeah.
And just sort of, you know, the thing that with my daughter, well, both of them is bone health. And this is one of the areas that I didn't fully appreciate when I was a younger clinician. But, you know, when you have a young female athlete, bone health is just critical. And there's a window of opportunity. So the U.S. Open is going on right now. And when you watch all these players, their dominant arm is, it's called tennis shoulder. This is published in 1976 by Priest and Nagel. And when you expose these kids to, especially in the lower extremity, you know, high impact, variable loading, axial loaded sports, it just does wonders for bone health. But you have a window of opportunity to really push the needle with bone health. And once you're out of that, you can still affect it, but not to the same extent. So that's something that, that's one of the greatest gifts that I can give her, is just to expose her to all these axial loaded sports and just variability. So yeah, I will not, and I'll be honest and thank my parents for never pushing me to go. Like, I could have very easily gone to Florida and to tennis camp. And they never pushed me in one direction or the other. And here I am, 41 years old, and I'm still pig and poop with this stuff. You know, like when people are like, hey, what's important to you? I'm like, training. And, you know, I'm still getting after it.
Yeah, it's crazy. I feel like burnout is, I don't want to get too much into that subject, but, you know, you talk to people who just train. I don't know of anyone who grew up playing one sport that doesn't absolutely hate it now. I feel like they all, when you just play that one sport, you're like, oh yeah, I played that since I was five till, you know, JUCO, junior college, and I haven't touched a tennis racket ever since, and I hate it. I feel like that happens so often.
I was hanging out with my tennis coach last night. He's been my probably my biggest influence as a coach. And, you know, he's like, hey, do you want to come up and play, you know, the doubles round robin? And I'm like, nope. Oh. I spent so much time, but I also, you know, ended up discovering triathlon. And I'm so glad I came to it from, you know, all these other different, you know, multi-directional sports. Not to mention like skateboarding, rollerblading, like all that stuff. So yeah, it's, I think we're in an interesting time where there is such a push. But look, I think a lot of parents are naive, and I don't mean that in a bad way, but you know, everyone thinks that their son or daughter is going to be the next greatest thing. And you'll know if they're the next greatest thing, because when they're 14 or 15, they'll be beating everyone in the region. You know, and so this, this woman, is it Sarah Risk? So she's playing in the U.S. Open. Mm-hmm. I used to play tennis with her older sister, Allie Risk. And look, she was probably beating everyone, guys and girls, you know, when she was 14, 15. You'll know if you have a freak athlete on your hands. So, you know, you want kids to get involved because of the camaraderie and the experiences and the life lessons that they'll learn. You know, but if you sense that they have an ability to go on and really push the needle, you need to A, identify that, which I think not everyone does, and B, be very calculated and know who you incorporate into that village, because it takes a village to get someone to that level.
Yeah. Dang. And to rehab somebody too, right? That would take a village to especially coming back from injury, you know, that of having that support team around.
Oh yeah. I mean, and I can't think of a more pressing situation than a young female athlete dealing with a bone stress injury, because once they get off to college, the trainers and the medical staff, they just, even in the most amazing programs, they probably don't have the bandwidth nor the ability to provide that athlete with individual attention to really get them out of trouble. And I talk about this a lot with Nathan Carlson on the Runner Zone, is like, if you have a young, gifted female runner and she's dealing with a bone stress injury, you have to get not only you need to have a physician involved, you need to have a nutritionist involved, you need to probably have a psychologist involved, you need to have a physical therapist involved, you probably need to have a strength coach involved. Then you have to have someone that runs point over all of that and communicates with all the other parties. And what's the reality of that? People are busy, and it demands a practitioner who cares and who gives a shit. And if you don't, all bets are off, especially with bone stress injuries. Those are the most complex things that, you know, that we can address. And like I said, I've had it so wrong, especially when I was younger, but you know, you just have to try and learn from your mistakes and improve.
It's heavy.
It's heavy.
Wound care and bone stress injuries, man.
Yeah. Where are you guys in your professional career? You're firing all these questions at me. Where are you in your professional career? What's a setting that you're in?
Basically, we just coming up on 1 year of practicing, right? Mm-hmm. When we're in Tyler and I are in an outpatient orthopedic clinic.
I spent about a year outpatient ortho, and then here in July switched to acute just because our hospital rotates. I'm at a VA, and so we see some interesting stuff. But
you know about that wound care life?
A little bit. I usually try not to deal with it, though, if I don't have to.
Yeah, it's stressful. I mean, you walk into some of these rooms, and you're just like, I'm going to unplug something, and the person's going to kick the bucket.
Yeah.
So I don't think a lot of folks, it's not the glitz and glam that a lot of other practitioners get to enjoy, but that's where you need to really, I think, revel in those experiences and those consultations, and just to really be present with people. So
yeah, that's kind of some of the feedback I got with acute care is like, I was one of the first clinicians to sit down and talk with them and listen to all the concerns that they had, because in the hospital it's so quick paced, like everything's just rapid fire, that sometimes people don't actually sit down and hear them out and deal with like the psychosocial aspect of acute care. Yeah. It's all just making sure they're not going to die.
Slow down, mellow, yeah. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think that's why my monotone voice does very well in a rehab sense. I've had a lot of patients who are like, I feel like my blood pressure, my heart rate just drops when I'm with you. Oh, I'm like, that's just my monotone voice. And I don't so.
I should probably stop yelling at people.
Yeah. Hey, how you doing today?
How's it going? Yeah.
Well, sometimes you need to yell at people. And it's just knowing, you know, the time and place to do that.
Yeah.
So.
I should be more gentle with my voice. Stop throwing it. I treat all my patients like they're here to watch me perform stand-up comedy. I yell.
If you're doing that, you're good. Yeah.
This guy gets it.
I think most clinicians, I think that they should have an improv specialist come in and do whether it's a weekend course or, you know, an elective. And I am dead serious. I used to actually I had a lot of friends who were in stand-up comedy in New York, and I would go out and hang with them. And that was a crisis experience. But if you can take improv classes, you will definitely – you won't be hurt by that in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
Because we're role-playing in a lot of ways, but we also have to be very aware of the decisions that we're making and the information that we're picking up. So I'm always sitting there ultimately trying to play chess with my patients, but we're on the same side of the board.
Yeah, 3D chess.
Yeah.
On BOSU balls.
Yeah.
Blindfolded.
Stable surface.
Yes. Did you ever do stand-up? Did you ever get on the mic?
I never got on the mic. I would always go there and probably drink too much. I had a lot of friends, and it was funny. It was a very strange community where it was like, if you were a comedian, there were a lot of inside jokes, and sometimes you know folks would just go up on stage and intentionally bomb to see the reaction of the crowd.
Again, that's how I treat my patients.
Yeah. So, and then you have to document what you told them.
Yeah. All my documentation is just, oh, Cheryl didn't find this funny. Still in pain.
I think that's more important than anything else that you're collecting, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think if someone's post-surgical, yeah, you want to know if they have any ideas and what their range of motion is, if they're coming out of a knee arthroscope or, say, an ACL reconstruction. But, I think that's the stuff that we should be documenting. You know, how was the person when they arrived? Were they pleasant? Were they distracted? Were they upset? Were they able to go through the exercises? Did they get any pushback? And did they walk out under their own power?
Yeah.
I think that's a death of our professions. We spend so much time. And I think there's a time and place, like, you know, with Trace being in an acute care setting. Yeah, I think that there's probably some things that you definitely want to document. But I think in outpatient, we document so much BS. And all it does is suck time and energy away from the time that you could otherwise be spending with that client. So,
truth.
Yeah. I used to write like novels, and I still am on top of all my notes, but I used to just write novels on people because I had a father who's a white collar crime lawyer. So I just got read the Riot Act all the time. But yeah, I think, like I said, a lot of the information that we're collecting is unnecessary. So,
you ready to ask him about Jay-Z?
I worked in a building where he had Rock the Mic recording.
Yeah.
So you talked about research with Jay-Z often?
No, I saw him a couple times outside of the facility in a fancy car. But no, he had a place in Prospect Heights, which was literally like a softball throw away from me, but I'm sure he has a lot of properties. But yeah, you know, I don't know. I listen to his station when I'm out cycling a lot of times.
Mm. Yeah. You gotta support your friends.
Yeah. I don't know if I would consider him a friend, but you know, he's someone who, I think you have to respect on a lot of levels.
Yeah. Have you seen, there's all these funny memes of, it's kind of titled, like Jay-Z didn't grow up with a dad. Jay-Z didn't do sports when he was a kid. And it's Jay-Z doing all these little athletic activities looking pretty bad. He doesn't have, like he's doing, like there's one where he's like taking a dive into a swimming pool and he just looks like he's falling. And it's, his motor skills don't seem to be on 100%. Like, yeah, he's got 99 problems. All of them motor skills. All of them gross motor abilities.
Well, yeah. He's obviously been blessed in a lot of other ways.
Yeah, I think he's good. I don't think he needs to worry about it.
He'll have an NFL franchise soon. He'll probably be over in like England or something. But
yeah.
Yeah.
So. That'll be cool. Yeah, man. See, you have a connection with him where you can be like the physio for his team.
That's the last thing I want to do. I could tell you some other stories about that, but I would have reservations about getting tangled up with a professional sports organization. I'll leave it at that. Right. You know, I think that certain ones have an incredible culture, but yeah, I would be very wary. I think a lot of people in our field would love that, and it would probably really stroke their ego until things hit the fan, and then, you know, you would get thrown under the bus. So a lot of it, you know, a lot of the medical staff sort of ebbs and flows with whoever the management is, you know, and if a team gets purchased or a new coach comes in, a lot of times you're going to just basically get kicked to the curb. So I don't think all organizations are like that, but I think a lot of them probably are. I never talk about that. I had a patient that told me, a very wise man when I was in New York, and he's since passed, but a very successful guy. And I don't mean that from a monetary standpoint, but, you know, that was part of it. But, you know, he always said, Chris, you know, I want you to just always, when you go to make a decision, you take money, sex, and power out of the equation and make your decision, and you'll never make a bad decision. Mm. And I think there's so much truth in that. And I think that we're in an era where everyone is, you know, on social media, and it's sort of a necessary evil these days and also an incredible avenue. But I think that you have to have a code, and you have to have a set of morals or values that you operate, operate by. And we're in a profession that we're here to help people. And, you know, if you can turn into something sexy, great, but do good by the people who come to see you and really be present with them and try and be a resource for them. Because, you know, life will take care of you.
Yeah. That's a great point.
Sorry to get off.
I'm all looking off into the galaxy right now.
Make better decisions.
Yeah. I mean, I was in New York. It's funny. People are like, do you want a cash-based practice? I'm like, well, some people pay with a credit card. So no, I don't think I do. I didn't even realize what it was. You know, that was just New York though. New York is a world unto itself.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you took insurance in New York, people are like, you must be abysmal.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I had no idea.
Well, not to say that there aren't, you know, certain clinics that are thriving, but, you know, in New York, everyone, they had their, you know, their guy or their gal. They're like, you got to go see this person. This is the only person to go see. So. But it was fun. If you took care of those people, invested in them, followed up with them, called them on occasion, checked in with them, you know, they really appreciated that because they knew that, you know, you were sincere and you were really trying to help them. You know what people do when that happens? They talk and they tell their friends and they tell their colleagues and they tell their family. You know, I always think that if you're in a cash-based setting and you don't get that person's family, their friends, everyone in their network, that something's wrong. So.
Heck yeah. What's your favorite, I don't want to say tactic. It's not really a tactic, but.
Strategy
or just how you connect with people. Some people like to do, you know, follow-up email. Some people are as personal as, hey, here's my personal phone number. I'm sure that's way more prevalent in a cash consulting scenario. Hey, here's my private number. Text me. If anything comes up, I'll have like a 24-hour response time. Is there one tip or one method of communication that you like
that gives you that? I think that you let the individual who's seeking your services dictate that. And I'll say, hey, look, I know, you know, you must be very busy, you know, not only between work and family and, you know, your social life. So, you know, I would love to make sure that we stay in communication because that will put me in a better position to help you. What works best for you? Mm-hmm. You know, that way you give them choices and people want to feel in control of the situation. You know, if someone, you know, I know a lot of people who just don't answer phone calls anymore and that's fine, but that's a generational thing. And you have to really understand, you know, is this a millennial? Is this a Generation X? Is it someone like my parents who probably, you know, wouldn't answer text, may not even know how to answer text? I would say that's unlikely, but, you know, you want to allow them to control the interaction. Mm-hmm. And as you start to foster trust, then you can start basically maybe nurturing that relationship a little bit more, or perhaps get on a phone call with them periodically. But you don't want them to feel like they have one more obligation or to-do thing on their punch list.
Yeah, that's great. So that's a great thing dropped during the eval.
Yeah, and I work with a lot of folks and a lot of very high level folks, and they never put me in touch with their secretary, assistant. I have a direct line to them. And these are people who don't have a lot of time, but you know what? Their communication with me is important. I'm the first person they reach out to in the event that things go south.
We know you're talking about Jay-Z. It's okay.
No, people on a much bigger level.
Oh. Oh. Cha-ching. Ba-boo.
There's always someone warming up with your Max.
That's right. Yes. Yes.
But, you know, these are
Obama, people, that's plantar fasciitis.
These are people who don't give a shit about that. Yeah. They want me to help them, and they trust me, and that's a trust that's been earned. Like, really, it's happened over years. And I also don't bullshit them. I'm very transparent with them, and I triage them sometimes. But I always try to get them in the best possible hands because, you know, I'm over trying to be a hero. And I think that as physical therapists, geez, we are in the most amazing position at this day and age to triage people. And that's why if you're a student and you're listening to this, that you go and you do an acute level fill, you do a neuro fill, you do a wound care fill, you do a prosthetics and orthotics fill. You do all of these because you'll have much greater perspective and your decision making will be so insanely refined. So
Heck yeah.
I go crazy, man. I feel like our profession gets pushed around a lot. And I also have a lot of respect for other professionals, you know. I don't get into turf battles. I think you try to, you know, we don't circle up and lock arms. You include everyone.
We in Texas now, we just got direct access this month.
That's awesome. Yeah, I'm so glad that passed. That's very important. So I don't know how, you know, the next thing is that we have to have, I need to be able to communicate with someone in New Jersey who, I can't tell you guys how often I get emails or messages from endurance athletes. They're like, hey, Chris, you know, I want to work with you. And I'm like, well, where are you? And, you know, what are you complaining of? Because I can't, right now, the system is not set up for me to consult you. And people may take a backdoor approach to that, but I just, you know, there are rules in place for a reason. And I said, well, look, I can connect you with certain people, but, you know, from everything that you're telling me, this is what I would suggest doing. But, you know, you have to appreciate this is not medical advice, but, you know, you have certain signs and symptoms that are consistent with a bone stress injury. And they're like, well, no, I've seen a bunch of people and no one has brought that up. And I'm like, well, can you just please follow up and I'll connect you with the right person. And they'll email me 2 days later, like, hey, you were right. I have a bone stress injury. And I'm like, oh, that's odd. Yeah. And that literally has happened 5 to 6 times in the past week. And people treat these as very like these blasé situations. And they're not. I'm like, you have pain on your bone in a high risk bone stress injury site. Like, I need to get you to the right people. And I do this out of, you know, trying to help folks because that's a profession that we're in. You know, and here I am like setting myself up for a potential trouble, but I always just say, look, I can't provide you medical advice, but I would channel you to the right people. And then they follow up because they obviously know I took the time to listen to them. And mm-hmm. Sure enough, they have a bone stress injury. I mean, and this is missed by people who they're seeing in person who just don't understand the moving parts or they're not listening to them. You know, so I'm curious to see this guy, Rob Vining. I've never met him, but you know, I need to be able to talk to someone who's in Texas, who's in New York, who's in Pennsylvania, because it's ridiculous that I can't, because I can pick up so much from a conversation. And when they start talking about their training history, I'm like, hey, look, and I'm like, hey, have you ever had a bone stress injury before? What's your relationship with food? What's your sleep? What's your weight training? What, like, you can figure out really quick. And if you have a remote suspicion of a bone stress injury, especially in a high risk area, you don't play around with that. That's a time where you get freaking imaging and you get an MRI. And if it shows up on an X-ray, you're screwed. So, you know, this is just something like our field we need to really, anyone who's like working in a legislative capacity, I know Mark Milligan is, I know Stephanie Weinrauch, like we need to have these people's backs because they know the value that we bring to the table. So plug them, support them, do anything that you can. So
have you, do you know about the PT licensure compact?
I don't.
Yeah, man. That's a shout out to Rob Vining, who's, and he's got amazing groups. I can send you a link to that. I don't know enough about it, but I know some states are getting in line. I just checked it out one time where you can go and you can purchase licensure in states that are have agreed to that. So Texas is one. Some range from like $30 to $40 a state. I can send you the link.
I think there's like eight states in a group or something. Yeah. Like Texas, Oklahoma.
And there's some
all together.
Yeah, there's
every state will in time adopt it, especially if they're getting paid.
Yeah. That's what yeah.
You should be able to do this over Zoom, and you have, I mean, talk about transparency. You have a recording of exactly what was said and what was communicated.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
I think it's silly that we document. I think that we should have body cams and have the patient say, like, are you cool with it, you know, if I flip this on, and it's, and you get a digital record.
Yes.
Because in when you walk out and say, look, do you understand everything that was discussed and was communicated? Do you have any questions? And they walk out and say, no. I mean, you have an instant replay.
Yeah. Heck yeah.
Whoa. Notes are such a joke to me. And anyone who says otherwise, please. You know? So I'm going to get into advocacy, and I'm going to get into legislation, and I'm going to approach it with an iron fist, but I'm going to be open to everything that, you know, folks on the other side of the table are discussing. But this all boils down to money and power with you know, a lot of the folks who are controlling those decisions. But no, it's interesting, but yeah, we need to push this stuff. So have folks backs.
Well,
yeah, you guys are real.
Yeah. Let's go.
You'll appreciate this. You know, you're 1 year out. I'm basically, I'm close to 17 years out. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
17 years?
Yeah.
Dang. You look so young.
Yeah, I'm a young buck, man. So. But this is a field that I'm very passionate about, and especially I do a lot of performance coaching now, and I work across that injury to performance spectrum, and I can't use that for marketing. All right. I never use that for marketing.
Why?
I think you have to be careful of saying that you have an advantage over another coach because you're a physical therapist. People intuitively know that. So you don't bring it up.
Okay. But
I understand if someone's dealing with a medical issue because they cannot be brought on as a coaching client, you know, and that's a whole nother discussion, mm-hmm. you know? So I have people that reach out to me all the time. They're like, hey, I want to coach with you. I'm like, you're having pain going up and downstairs. We can't engage in this.
Mm.
So
that's respecting those different fields. Like you do so well of acknowledging that.
Well, cause a lot of people don't, and they're the ones who create a problem. You know, it's one thing if you're working with someone who's trying to qualify for Kona, who is training consistently and healthy, and they want to pick my brain about, you know, how they can approach their program design or strength and conditioning and how all this stuff interfaces. But you have to trace that back. That's not someone who's having an issue with eating, dressing, bathing, community ambulation. They're like, hey, I'm like ready to put my life on the line to qualify for this event. You know, and I'm very confused when people talk about performance physical therapy, and that may be, you know, semantics depending on the state that they're in. But performance physical therapy to me is a little bit of an oxymoron, you know, and I've said this before, you know, you trace this back to Claire Ardain's article in BJSM, you know, where it's return to participation, return to sport, return to performance. When I communicate that, it's rehab to train to compete to redefine your limits. And you have to know where someone is on that spectrum. And if you don't, you're going to create a shitstorm for yourself and that person, you know. But if I'm working with an athlete and they're like, hey, I started developing calf pain, as clinicians, it's a very different set of questions that you start asking them.
Yeah.
Tell me more. You're having calf pain, you know, are you having any shortness of breath? Are you tolerant of weight bearing? You know, or is this something that is perhaps something innocuous? But most folks don't understand those questions, and that's why we've gone through didactic training.
Yeah. Crap. That's a lot. Slap the defense. Man. Yeah.
Deep dive.
Yeah.
I don't play around with this stuff because you know what? It's my family who, not only myself, but my family who's on the hook.
Yeah.
So other people can be lackadaisical. That's on them. You know, but I'm very calculated with who I work with, and I really vet people, you know, especially, you know, folks who are reaching out from a performance coaching standpoint.
Yep. I sent you some links that I do on the Instagrams that I saw that Rob Vining shared. Check about the PT Compact and what that means. Again, I don't know enough about it to talk about it, but we can have Rob on again.
Yeah, he was just on, I think, Jared Carter's podcast.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, he's a great person to get on. I'll listen to it. I listen to a lot more podcasts than people realize, so.
Yeah, there's so many.
Only on conversation pace runs or aerobic rides, though, because if I'm doing, like, intervals, it totally distracts me.
Batman.
Dude, but, like, might as well put Kenny G on.
You don't work out, Kenny G?
No, only if I'm recovering.
It's more of a return to participation playlist.
Or I'm trying to get in the mood.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. Is this a real Kenny G song? I don't know what Kenny G titles his songs.
But is that a real
title?
What?
They don't need a title.
They don't need a title! Have you? I've gone down a rabbit hole of watching Kenny G music videos, and it is quite entertaining.
You need to get a life.
Don't judge my YouTube consumption, man. Yeah. It's good study music. Kenny G helped me pass the NPTE.
We need to get you guys out more.
Oh God. Anything left on the notebook?
I've been the notebook has been fulfilled.
Fulfilled.
It's overfloweth.
Overfloweth. Yeah.
He's dropped more research articles and names than I thought. I knew everyone in the field. I was like, yeah, I know Greg Lehman. You know, no big deal. I know Rob Vining. And then I'm like, oh no.
You know all those research articles he was talking about.
Yeah, he's like busting. He's like, this happened in 1974. Oh no, I don't know any of this.
That's a tough article to get, and it when you print it out, it's like it's in a different landscape format. But yeah, I mean, I bring this up because, you know, if someone came in and they were a competitive tennis player, and, you know, I won't bore you with any more PT talk, but
no,
you know, if someone came in and they had tennis shoulder and you didn't understand that that's a sport-specific adaptation that's associated with an apparent scoliotic curve, you would be barking up the complete wrong tree. You know, I had, when I was in New York, we used to have a lot of the sports fellows who were training with Dr. Nicholas and his team. They would come and hang with us, and they were like, hey, you have a scoliotic curve. And I'm like, you know, and they were required to hang with us as PTs, so they got a better lay of the land. And, you know, it was fun because you could just lay into them, you know, and be like, let me pull you aside here, doc. Let's talk a little bit because I think you need to go and do some homework. It was fun. It was all, you know.
Yeah.
All in good fun. But, you know, I said, look, I was a left-handed tennis player. And, you know, obviously I have greater mass on this side. So you have a more depressed shoulder, protracted in terms of, like, medical speak. But yeah, if you don't understand that sport-specific adaptation, if you didn't understand that I hit an open stance forehand on my left and I was left-handed, you would think I would have all sorts of things going on. But these are sport-specific adaptations. Watch Nadal. Look at his left versus his right arm. Any of these tennis players.
Yeah.
You know, consider whether they're hitting an open stance forehand versus, you know, more of an Eastern grip versus a two-handed backhand versus a one-handed back. Like, it shows you all the factors and considerations that enter the equation. And there's probably a bunch that I'm not even seeing that are seeing me. So that's why PT is amazing, because we're very conservative in nature, and we should be, right? So we haven't even talked about baseball. throw tennis shoulder in with acromiale, two surgeries with a mid-shaft clavicular fracture. You don't understand that. Like, you should not be treating that person. So, and I don't say this to scare you guys. I say it to, you know, just make you appreciate all the moving parts.
Yeah.
So if you don't select that in a history because you're in an outpatient setting and you're rushed, shit, that's not good.
Yeah.
So be conservative.
And just there's so many details to appreciate. And that's what, and we go back to advocacy too, of like, you hear somebody, you know, we could say insulting the profession or just not having a full scope. Like, oh, you're a glorified personal trainer. You just make people do TheraBand exercise. You just get people stronger. You know, as simple as we know, Lehman loves to say, calm shit down, build shit back up. But it's hearing those details like that of how thorough you can be as a clinician. That's just like, there's endless opportunities to improve somebody and demonstrate your worth of, like, you know, just what Chris said of like being that thorough with an athlete's rehab or anybody's rehab, when you get to the functional details and nuances of their daily life and how a conservative approach can be better than just, oh, let's go in surgery and cut some things.
And to what extent, you know, in certain times they have more credence than others. I mean, that's the thing about Greg is, Greg is razor sharp, and I've spent a lot of time and I've communicated with him. You know, at day's end, he knows full well the decisions that he's making, and he has just a very casual, subtle way of presenting this stuff, which is good, because as much as I sit here and talk about a lot of these details, to some extent they matter more than others. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think that the beauty of Greg is that, you know, he wants people to use the knowledge base that they have and to trust in it, and, you know, to also be conservative and challenge the body, because that's when it adapts. Rest, inactivity, you know, suboptimal loading is a recipe for disaster, you know. So now you obviously have to appreciate biologic healing time frames, but most of the time someone's coming in, you know, for conservative management and it's an atraumatic mechanism of injury, you're going to probably just want to figure out the entry point to loading them and do it in a progressive, you know, dynamic manner. So
one, I know this topic can be talked about a lot, but I know we're running short on time, is I do oftentimes hear clinicians be like, oh, you hear someone who's been, they say, oh, PT is boring. It gets boring after a while. It's so repetitive. And I don't, personally, I'm like, I don't know what the hell you're talking about. I'm learning about tennis shoulder and all sorts of stuff every day. Like, I don't know where that repetitive, does it feel repetitive and boring to you, Chris? Or does it feel challenging? Does it ever not feel challenging?
The second it stops feeling challenging, that's when I go to get my PhD, because I need to go and take a deep dive with some. We haven't talked about a few things, but, you know, I think that we're masters at pattern recognition and being present with people. And that's a really potent combination. You know, when I can hear someone say, hey, this is what I've been dealing with, here's what's going on in my life. And, you know, you have to ask these questions in a calculated manner. But when you start really getting a lay of the land, you understand the emotional backdrop of someone's life, you understand the demands that are placed on them, well, only then can you start making decisions about how to load them or unload them. But most of the time, you're going to load that person. And when I say load, you know, obviously, it could be strengthening exercises, it could be a range of motion exercise. I mean, it depends on the context. But no, I mean, I think that the devil is in the nuances and the details. But really simplifying and distilling all this information down, you know, to a couple very simple interventions. You know, I think someone who's done amazing work, go listen to Chris Littlewood's podcast. You know, when he talks about someone loading their shoulder well, they're waiting for the kettle to make their tea. He's over in the UK, you know, and he talks about how simple some of these loading strategies can be. My greatest concern or fear is that I'm overcomplicating things. You know, so as much as I put out all these videos and exercises that people see, you would laugh if you came to hang with me if you were a fly on the wall seeing one of my treatment sessions. Because a lot of times I'm going to give people two or three exercises that people are like, oh yeah, I do those all the time. Like, yeah, but you're probably cheating them every which way. So let's just really, you know, make sure that you get dialed in on this stuff and have a practice and fail and curse. And, you know, it's about process. And it's about, it's tending to these things, you know, and making it a priority. So, no, but look, I feel so fortunate to be a physical therapist, and I feel like I'm in one of the most amazing positions in the world to help folks who are in need, who are dealing with pain. And that's a primary reason that people come to see us. If people are like dancing around, playing tennis, you know, paddleboarding, you know, riding their bike, running without issue, they're not going to come to see us. People come to see us when they're dealing with pain and dysfunction. Or, you know, something has been compromised in their ability to go about their life. And that's why, you know, to keep stroking Greg's ego, his course has such relevance. It's reconciling pain and biomechanics. So it's good to hear that you guys are following him. You know, I look to him to refine a lot of my own thoughts. And he's into truths, but he's also into seeking common denominators. You know, when you look at all these different studies, you know, when you take a step back, it's like, well, it seems like we should probably give this person something to challenge that region.
Yeah.
You know, with all the runners that I work with, and it's funny, I've gotten pigeonholed into running, even though my roots and research are in the shoulder and having spent a lot of time with spine and ACL reconstruction. But, you know, at day's end, when you look at the common denominators of all of the research, you know, it's basically challenge the body and calling it to adapt, and probably will, you know, and don't set the bar too high with biomechanics for the most part. So.
Yeah. I'm going to go charge my computer in real quick.
I'll bring the charger over here.
Hey, go grab it. Trace, do you have anything as we kind of find ourselves over the hour mark?
I don't think so. I think I'm good. It's been dropping knowledge for an hour straight. I feel like my brain hurts.
Yeah, I'm definitely more on that.
The one thing, like, you know, when Greg talks about loading, I think that the one caveat that I would make to that is whether you're teaching someone movement variability, you have to get them to directly load through the regions that are involved. And that's something that I see. Just, it's a catastrophic mistake that a lot of clinicians make, is they don't, like, if I'm going to work with someone who's a runner, they have to be able to fully load through that calf muscle complex, for example. And if they can't, I just, you know, I have reservations about getting them back to running. Now, granted, we can do certain things, you know, to basically shift the loads around the lower extremity. But at some point, they have to be able to load directly through that region, unless they're just so far gone, where if someone has like medial compartment knee OA and they're a heel striker and they want to keep running, you probably want to convert them to a mid to 4 foot striker. And you could probably do that primarily through step rate manipulation. But that's an instance where that's an exception to the rule, because you better make sure they have the calf capacity to withstand those forces, because running, 50% of the energy is already coming from the calf, and you're going to shift it further to the calf in someone who's already losing ankle power as a master's level athlete based on Paul DeVita's work, you know? So, yeah.
My brain hurts.
Yeah. So, well, hopefully this gives you some perspective. I'm just...
Yeah. No, it was awesome stories.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I'm just a washed up 41-year-old master's athlete trying to hold on to my youth and yeah.
And doing bunny hops over potholes.
Hey.
Going 35.
Yeah. That's about as hardcore as I get these days.
Yeah, that's metal, dude.
Metal, man. I would have the teeth would have been gone.
Hey.
Front teeth gone.
Hey. You don't need them.
Don't need them.
You drink smoothies all the time anyway.
That's right. What kind of plugs do you?
Plugs.
Plugs in terms of plugging certain folks?
plugging certain
plugging yourself.
Yourself.
There's nothing for me to plug. If people know where to find me, and I don't want to sit here and sound like some saint. I actually like when people find me organically because I know that there's something good that's going to happen. I do zero marketing. I have all this stuff online. I can sit here and talk about that, but to me, I want people who are looking to refine their perspective on things, who think that I may be someone who could serve as a good mentor or resource. And at this point, it's not about me. I'm doing a lot of work with Joel Sackgast, Nathan Carlson, and a bunch of folks who are part of this online community who has an interest in running. That's fun. Lindsay Plass has been involved, and a bunch of other people. There's nothing to plug at this point. I guess I'm at a point in my career where I just want to help folks. And but again, I don't want to be a saint. I don't want to come across as sounding like a saint. So I have resources that are out there. If people want to find them, great. And I'll leave it at that.
I just want to throw it in here. I'm going to talk about the running clinic. So I was a part of the Runner Zone group for probably like 6 months. I was part of the runners group, and Jared was there to help me. I've been a longtime Orange Theory coach. For those people who don't know, Orange Theory is 23 to 30 minutes of treadmill every class, right? So it's a whole lot of running every time. People are runners there, blah, blah, blah. And I was fortunate enough to give a few running classes, and I basically just, I don't want to say stole, but very much looked into all your stuff that you had, and I took it all. And the coaches there, the regional coach was at one of them, and they went to a nationwide running seminar where it was the nationwide for Orange Theory, which is a big thing. Gave all the regional coaches things like this is what you need to do to teach it. And one of the coaches was like, that was better than what I got at the big sir, the big what's that called, session conference thing. That was better material. So and that was just all through pretty much your stuff. That's where I got almost all my information. So it was very helpful.
Well, that's awesome.
Yeah.
And that validates everything. I always hope that everyone who's a part of that community, being the Runner Zone, I guess there's my plug, the Runner Zone. I just hope that I can get into a clinic with folks. And with all of these Con Ed courses that I do, I want it to almost be a weekend, because I think therapists in particular, most physical therapists, they do great with repetition and seeing patterns and seeing like the common denominators. And I just hope I can get into a clinic with all these people, because when you see this stuff straight away, but you really see the conversations and the dialogue that happens between myself or anyone else who's active on the Runner Zone. There's a saying in motivational interviewing that you're dancing with a client. And we get into these conversations where, I do a lot of consultations these days, and when people come to see me and they leave, they're like, I can't believe what you have me doing. Like they come in having been doing like clamshells, which are fine. It's a great activation exercise for the lateral hip. But when they leave, they're like, geez, like you tap into this like alter ego of theirs, but you're also doing things to really push the needle, because you need this, especially with tendon related disorders, bone stress injuries too, but you have to be careful. We can't just lump it in. You need to understand how and when to stoke the fire. And that's critical, because these structures won't adapt if you don't know how to stoke the fire. And certain exercises are just not going to get it done. I just see a lot of low level, suboptimal loading dancing around the issue, But yeah, I'll leave you with this. If you want to give an exercise, or two to a runner, give them loaded carries and something to load their soleus and their calf muscle complex. Or you could combine the two and do the kettlebell creep.
Yes.
Yeah. These things push the needle. So, and I'm sort of a, you know, skinny punk triathlete, and I can comfortably handle my body weight between two, like, so, you know, if I'm doing a loaded carry, I can handle 80 pounds in each hand casually.
Yeah. Heck yeah.
So people don't understand the loads that they have to withstand to run, and once they start getting connected with that and they're cool with it is when things start to happen. Again, you have to understand who the person is, where they're coming from, their experience with resistance training. You can't just go from A to Z, you know, overnight, unless you want to create another issue. So,
yeah. And if you need a clinic in Austin, we got you, man.
Anytime. I don't market myself to teach, but you know, if people ever want to bring me in, I have a course that's rock solid. And Nathan and I we're going to do a course, the first time we're going to present it, called Bones, Tendons, Weights, and Whistles.
Yes.
And it's all about understanding, managing bone stress injuries, tendon-related disorders, resistance training, and ultimately taking someone from being in the medical system to migrating them out of the medical system, and then talking about performance coaching. So if you're not turning an injury into a PR, with someone who's relatively healthy and it's important to them, something's awry.
Mm, shit.
Yeah.
Put you on notice.
Yeah. So, so let me know. And this course has been approved in Texas before. So.
Hey, there we go.
Texas Chris. PT Association is crazy though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's another episode.
Yeah. They sent me approval like 9 months later. I'm like, yeah, I canned that course. I didn't hear back from you. So,
thanks.
I'm talking too much. I don't usually talk this much.
No, this is awesome, man. Anything else?
No, Chris? I love it. I love
that
it.
That was beautiful, man.
Good.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Yeah. All right. Well, hey, I appreciate you guys having me on. And if there's anything I can ever do to help you with the Duck Legs podcast, I think that's a cool, catchy name.
Thanks, man.
Have fun with this stuff. You know, that's all I'll leave you with. Have fun with it. Get people who are on that are upbeat and passionate, and you know, and just get into some serious conversations.
Yeah. So, thank you for having one with us.